Welcome back to the Deep Dive. You know, when we think about industrial steelmaking, it's easy to fall into that romantic image of a blacksmith, right? The rhythmic clanging, the glowing metal, that singular focus.
Ideally, a very cinematic blacksmith.
Exactly. But today, we are shattering that image. We're diving into a reality that is infinitely more chaotic. We're talking about the sheer unmanageable complexity of what actually happens when you try to smash modern steel at temperatures hot enough to make it glow like the sun.
It really is a chaotic dance. I mean, we are just hitting metal. We're dealing with temperature, pressure, strain rates, and a whole periodic table's worth of chemical elements all, you know, fighting each other at the atomic level.
And to navigate this chaos, we aren't using a hammer. We're using a digital brain. Today, we're unpacking a master's thesis from the University of Cambridge by Matthew Peat, supervised by the renowned Professor HKDH Padatia. The title is Neural Network Modeling of Hot Deformation of Austenite.
It sounds incredibly dense, but the mission here is fascinating. It's about seeing if artificial intelligence, specifically these things called neural networks, can outperform the traditional physics equations.
In predicting how steel behaves when it's being, well, tortured at high temperatures.
Exactly.
And we should context set here. This is from 2001. So this is right at that transition period, moving from old school linear regression to these more advanced Bayesian neural networks. So let's transport ourselves to the hot strip mill. What is physically happening to the metal?
We are focusing on a very specific phase of steel called austenite.
Which is the high temperature phase of iron.
Right. When you heat steel up, and we're talking, you know, typically above 900 degrees Celsius, the crystal structure changes. It becomes gamma iron, or austenite. At this temperature, it's soft enough to be shaped, which is what we call hot rolling.
So you're taking a massive cast ingot and rolling it down into a thin steel strip.
That's it.
But I'm guessing soft is a very relative term here. It's not Play-Doh.
Far from it. And this is where hot deformation gets so tricky. You have to account for this massive web of variables. You've got the chemical composition, carbon manganese, silicon molybdenum, then the temperature, then the strain, how much you're deforming it, and finally the strain rate.
How fast you're smashing it.
And all of these change how the steel fights back. We're looking at the stress strain curve, right? As you push, the resistance goes up.
It gets harder to push.
It does. It reaches a peak, and then, interestingly, the stress drops to a steady state.
Now, that's weird. At room temperature, metal usually just gets harder the more you work it. That's work hardening. But here, the stress drops.
It does, because at these high temperatures, you have two competing mechanisms. On one hand, you're tearing up the crystal structure, creating defects called dislocations. That makes the metal harder. But because it's hot, the metal is desperately trying to heal itself.
And this healing is where the materials differ.
Exactly. In metals like, say, aluminum or alpha iron, you get what's called dynamic recovery. The defects just slide around and annihilate each other so the curve stays smooth. But austenite gamma iron is more dramatic. It chooses dynamic recrystallization.
So it doesn't just patch the cracks. It rebuilds the entire house while you're still living in it.
That is a perfect way to put it. It literally spawns new defect-free grains of crystal right in the middle of all that stress. And that process consumes the energy, causing the resistance to drop.
And the deciding factor here is something called stacking fault energy.
Right. Think of stacking fault energy as how sticky the defects are. If the energy is high, defects can slide around and cancel each other out easily. That's recovery. If it's low, like it is in austenite, they get tangled up, they stick, and the pressure just builds and builds until the metal is forced to recrystallize just to survive.
So we have this complex, almost biological regeneration happening inside a red-hot slab of steel. Predicting the flow stress, basically how much force the mill needs to apply, is vital if you get it wrong.
You break the mill, or you produce miles of scrap metal. And this is where the old math really started to fail us.
The thesis talks about these constitutive equations, Zener-Holleman, Hall-Petch. I mean, these are the titans of material science math.
They are, and they are elegant. The Zener-Holleman parameter, for instance, combines strain rate and temperature into a single number. But the problem is, these equations rely on constants.
Constants that act like, what, fudge factors.
Exactly. You have to fit the equation to your data. So you test a specific steel, you find the constants, let's call them N and K, and then you have a formula that works for that one steel.
But that implies you're just chasing your own tail. Every time you tweak the alloy, add a pinch of nickel, drop the carbon.
Those constants break. You're back in the lab running expensive physical tests just to update your math. You're stuck in a loop. And, well, strictly speaking, the math itself was flawed. It relied very heavily on linear regression.
Which sort of assumes the world is flat.
Right. It tries to draw a straight line through data that is behaving like a roller coaster. Pete's thesis describes the reality of steel strength as a complex, bumpy surface.
And linear regression just cuts a flat plane right through that surface, missing all the peaks and valleys.
Precisely. And that leads to contradictions. I mean, Pete reviews literature where one paper says carbon increases strength and another one says it decreases it. A linear equation can't handle that. It wants a single slope. It can't understand that carbon might make steel harder at 800 degrees, but maybe softer at 1100, depending on what else is in the suit.
Okay, so to map that bumpy surface, Pete turned to the neural network.
The black box.
But let's demystify that a bit. In 2001, this was cutting edge. The thesis proposes using a neural network to learn the shape of the data. And it does this using weights, biases, and a hyperbolic tangent function.
Which sounds intimidating, but it's actually quite visual.
It's essentially a mathematical S-curve.
Yeah. Right?
It gives the model flexibility.
Precisely. Unlike a ruler that only draws straight lines, these hyperbolic tangent S-curves can bend and twist. By stacking enough of them together, the network can trace any shape, no matter how bumpy or chaotic that stress landscape gets.
But here's the part that sets this thesis apart. This wasn't just any AI. The thesis makes a massive deal about using a Bayesian framework, which was proposed by McKay.
This is the secret sauce. And honestly, it's the only responsible way to use AI in engineering.
Because standard AI is a bit arrogant.
It is. Think of standard AI like a bad weather app. It says it will rain at 2:00 p.m. No nuance, just a statement. And if it doesn't rain, you're soaked and angry.
Whereas the Bayesian framework is the meteorologist who says there's a 60% chance of rain, but honestly, the wind patterns are weird, so we aren't totally sure.
Exactly. The Bayesian framework gives you the answer, plus error bars. It quantifies its own doubt.
Which is vital in a steel mill. If the model says, this alloy has a strength of 200 megapascals, but the error bar is plus or minus 100.
It's effectively telling you, don't build a bridge out of this yet. For industrial safety, knowing when the model is clueless is just as important as knowing when it's right.
Plus, the framework uses something called regularization to prevent overfitting.
Which is just a fancy way of stopping the model from memorizing the noise and the data instead of learning the actual trends.
Okay, so Matthew Pete has his tool, this Bayesian neural network. Now he needs to teach it. He needs data.
He secured data from Corus's Swindon Technical Center. He had 24 different steels for training the model, and then he kept 6 aside for testing it later.
And these weren't simple recipes. We're talking carbon, silicon, manganese, chromium, nickel, molybdenum, copper, vanadiums. Quite a soup.
It is. And the first attempt, Model 1, was fascinating because of how spectacular the failure was.
This is the raw data model.
Right. He just fed the raw numbers straight into the neural network. Temperature in Celsius, raw strain rate. He just let the AI look at the numbers.
And the result.
It worked okay in the middle where he had lots of data, but in the gaps, it made just nonsense predictions. For example, under certain conditions, it predicted negative stress.
Which is physically impossible. You can't have negative resistance when you're compressing something. That would mean the metal is pulling the machine down.
Correct. The computer didn't know the laws of physics. It was just looking for patterns in data that was all clumped together.
So this is where Pete got clever with Model 2. He decided to teach the AI some physics. Instead of raw temperature, he gave it the inverse of absolute temperature, 1 over T. Instead of raw strain, he used natural logarithms, LEN.
He was feeding the data in a format that already matched the Arrhenius equations and power laws that you find in nature.
But wait, let me play devil's advocate here. Isn't that kind of cheating? If we're building an AI to learn the patterns, why do we have to hard code the physics laws into it first? Shouldn't it figure that out on its own?
You could let it try, but you'd need millions of data points and years of training time. By pre-packaging the inputs to match the underlying physics, we're giving it a huge head start. We aren't telling it the answer. We're just teaching it the language of thermodynamics so it can learn the answer much, much faster.
That makes sense. It's like giving a student a dictionary instead of asking them to decipher a whole language from scratch.
Exactly. And the result was much better predictions. No more negative stress. It started to recognize the real relationships.
But he didn't stop there. He went on to models 3 and 4 to tackle the chemistry part.
Right. And this is where he applied solid solution strengthening theory. The theory suggests that the strength an alloy adds is proportional to the square root of its atomic percentage.
So not just the amount, but the square root of the amount.
Right. So he fed the model the square root of the atomic percentage of each of the elements, and that was the breakthrough. When he did that, the model stopped predicting negative stress entirely and got much more accurate for those high-strain scenarios.
It really emphasizes that the best AI isn't just a black box, it's a collaboration between human theory and machine learning.
It is. And to further reduce error, he used a committee of models. So instead of relying on one neural network, he trained several. The final prediction was just the average of the committee. It helps average out any random noise.
Okay, so we've built the beast, we've trained it with these physics-informed inputs. What did it actually find? Did we solve the mystery of carbon?
We did get some clarity. Remember how I said the literature was contradictory? Well, specifically for grade 25C steel at 800 degrees Celsius, the model showed that carbon increased the flow stress.
Okay, so in that specific context, carbon makes it harder to squash.
Yes, but here's the aha moment. In that same context, manganese and silicon appeared to reduce the flow stress,
which contradicted some of the other papers he reviewed.
So specifically, Medina and Hernandez, who had suggested those elements should increase strength. And this really highlights the power of the neural network. It captured these non-linear interactions that human intuition was missing. It suggests that, well, maybe silicon interacts with carbon in a specific way at 800 degrees to soften the whole matrix.
Now, we do have to talk about the blind spot. This model was incredibly smart about carbon and silicon, but it completely whiffed on vanadium.
The vanadium disappointment.
Right. We know vanadium strengthens steel. It forms these little precipitates.
Mm-hmm.
But the AI didn't see it.
Because it wasn't shown enough examples. It's the classic garbage in, garbage out, or in this case, nothing in, nothing out. The neural network is a prisoner of its training data. If you don't show it the phenomenon, it just assumes it doesn't exist.
Which is a sobering reminder. The AI isn't magic. It's just a very, very advanced pattern matcher.
Exactly. And that limitation was proven in the final extrapolation test. Pete took the model and tested it on six steels it had never seen before. Steels 1 through 6.
And how did it do?
For high temperatures, it worked beautifully. It predicted the behavior of these new steels very accurately.
There's a but.
There's a but. For steels 1 and 2, at low temperatures, around 700 degrees Celsius, it failed completely. The predictions were way off.
Was the model just broken?
No, the physics changed. At 700 degrees, those specific low-carbon steels started to transform from austenite into ferrite.
The crystal structure changed. We left the austenite party and walked into the ferrite party.
Exactly. And the model was trained only on austenite. It had no idea what ferrite was. It was like asking a chef who only knows Italian food to cook a Japanese dinner. It just didn't have the reference points.
But this brings us back to the Bayesian win, right?
Yeah.
This is the moment the error bars really shine.
It does. The model failed to predict the right stress, but the error bars were enormous. The computer was effectively screaming, "I don't know what's happening here. Do not trust me."
Which, for a metallurgist running a mill, is exactly what you want to hear. You don't want a confident wrong answer. You want a warning.
Precisely. The error bars correctly identified that the prediction was unreliable. That is a success in my book.
So let's bring this all together. We started with the chaos of the hot strip mill, where these old equations just couldn't cope with the complexity of modern alloys.
We moved to neural networks, specifically these Bayesian ones that offer a crucial safety net of probability.
And we saw that you can't just dump raw numbers in. You have to speak the language of the physics, using logarithms, square roots, inverse temperatures to help the AI learn faster.
And we learned that while the AI is powerful, it is strictly bound by its experience. It can't invent new physics, like predicting ferrite when it's only ever seen austenite.
But the real-world impact of this is huge. Instead of melting tons of steel to see what happens, you can run a simulation.
You can design alloys on a computer, you can tweak the carbon, dial back the manganese, and see what happens to the flow stress before you ever turn on a furnace. And thanks to the Bayesian error bars, you know exactly how risky your new design is.
It's like having a map that not only shows you the road, but also tells you where the map ends.
That's a great way to put it.
Now, here is a thought to leave you with. The thesis concludes that the model is limited by the data. The holes in the data create those big error bars. So, could we flip the script?
What do you mean by that?
Instead of scientists just randomly deciding what experiments to run next, could the AI look at its own error bars, identify the biggest gaps in its knowledge, and then tell the scientists, go melt this specific alloy next? Could the AI eventually direct the research to make itself smarter?
That is a fascinating concept. An AI that doesn't just answer questions, but starts asking them, that would change the scientific method entirely.
Something to mull over. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the world of hot steel and digital brains.
It was a pleasure.
See you next time.